I'm Bob Franklin. Thanks very much for joining me. This is Like It Is. We resume our conversation from last week on White Women, Black Men, Illicit Sex in the 19th Century South. I'm joined by the author of the book, Dr. Martha Hodes, a history professor at New York University.
Dr. Hodes, I want to talk to you now about, as we move closer and closer to the Civil War and what happened to blacks after the Civil War. But before we get there, the role of the courts and how they interpreted disputes between landowners and sometimes enfranchised blacks who won that enfranchisement by virtue that their offspring, their mother was white. Those who challenged paternity, divorce, and petitions of freedom, how did the courts react to some of these challenges?
I'm sorry, the challenges, this is in the antebellum South you're talking about?
Yes.
The courts almost always took the side of the slave owners. And what that meant, once again, was preserving the property of white people in slaves. Now, the court was also, at the same time, extremely careful about making sure that the children of white women should not be enslaved. That was a very important law in the South. And so if a white woman had had a child by a black man, even though that child was of partial African ancestry, the courts very much stuck to the letter of the law that the child of a white woman could not be enslaved. What the courts did instead, in many cases, was they attempted to make those children as close to slavery as possible without legal enslavement. And the major means of doing that was by apprenticeship. In other words, the woman I talked about before, Polly Lane, who gave birth to the child of the slave named Jim, who was subsequently pardoned for what she had claimed was rape, their child, if you look in the census records, the case took place in North Carolina, was apprenticed to a white farmer. And so by that apprenticeship, it was the closest approximation to slavery that the court could impose on a child who legally had to be free. The same goes back to the descendants of Nell Butler. They were the descendants of a white woman. And in the 1760s, when they brought their case to the Maryland court, the court was adamant that the children or descendants of white women could not be enslaved. Although they had been in the colonial era, that was something that antebellum era courts did not want to see happen. Now, sometimes what happened is courts were unable to decide whether somebody really was descended from a white woman or not. And those are fascinating cases because they speak to how difficult it was to recall or determine someone's ancestry. For example, there are cases in the book in which people sue courts for their freedom, people who say my mother or grandmother was a white woman, and then it's up to the court and the white jury to decide whether the person's maternal ancestor really was white or was Native American or was somehow of African descent very far back. And what you have are people coming into court unable to agree on what race or what racial identity they should assign to various people. So I guess I would emphasize that many of the court cases were very confusing, and the evidence was very confusing. It wasn't straightforward, and yet the court was very sincere about making sure that the children of white women were not enslaved. That would have violated the idea of the rights of white women versus the rights of black women. In other words, the children of black women were always enslaved. And for that very reason, the children of white women could never be enslaved because the status of black and white women could never be so close, could never be so much the same.
Now, the charge of rape, you touched on that earlier. What happened to the accused if found guilty, the black man in this case, if found guilty of rape? And did your research uncover any cases of men falsely accused? And you have mentioned that of our previous. How did the legal system handle cases where black men were found guilty of rape?
This is again in the antebellum period you're talking about?
Yes, I'm still in the antebellum period.
Well, one of the main mechanisms of countering a conviction of rape, and let me just go back first and say that black men who were accused of rape were often convicted, and that points to the kinds of roots of what would happen in the era of lynching. But what happened in the antebellum era was that after conviction, very often, almost all cases in this kind of circumstance, the black man would be pardoned. And he would be pardoned on the grounds of some of the things I mentioned earlier. The white woman had a bad reputation, or it wasn't really his fault, or he was valuable property to his master. So what that indicated was that the conviction served to establish some sort of guilt on the part of the black man. But the pardon then served to retain the property value of the man and spared the man from capital punishment. So you have a kind of dual system going on here where white people do acknowledge or do consent to the idea that the man was guilty of rape, and probably in most cases he wasn't. But then at the same time, they double back and save the man as property for the master by pardoning him on grounds that appear very sympathetic to the slave and very unsympathetic to the white woman. For example, if you read through these cases, you will see that the women were described in terrible and derogatory terms. And then people would come forward and say, oh, Jim was a good slave, or Charles was such a hardworking slave. And so it seems as if they are on the side of the slave, and yet it's very important to remember that they are on the side of the slave only because they are retaining the property interests of the master.
Then that all changed somehow, and we are now at the Civil War. What role did the Civil War play in changing attitudes of sexual relationships between white women and black men? And I'm just curious, what was it about the Civil War that so dramatically caused the increasing violence to black men who had sexual relations with white women against or pressured by others' wills?
Well, the main event of the Civil War that led to a tremendous change in everything I've just described was, put simply, emancipation, the freedom of the slaves. And that changed everything. You know, historians usually like to put forth models of change that are slow and gradual, take place over a long period of time. And as a historian trained in that way, I looked for that kind of model. But what I found instead was that emancipation was such an enormous change in the South and for white Southerners that it changed forever everything that I describe in the first half of the book. What emancipation meant was that the social order that had been kept in place by the institution of slavery was no longer able to be kept in place because black men and women were free. What that meant was that liaisons between black men and white women now threatened white supremacy in a way that they had never threatened white supremacy before, because slavery had kept white supremacy alive. And so one of the things I found is that black men were the ones who were granted the vote after the Civil War. They were the ones who, during a brief period of Reconstruction, became landowners. Some of them did own their own land, farm their own land. And those kinds of privileges, land owning and suffrage, were so galling to white Southerners. What began to happen, and this did, I should say, happen gradually from the Civil War, from emancipation through Reconstruction in the 1870s, and then in the 1880s and 1890s, there was a change over those 30 years, so that during the Civil War, whites didn't so much express the fear of sex between white women and black men, but they began to look at these liaisons with new eyes, wondering what this would mean now that slavery was no longer in place. What happened during Reconstruction, from 1865 through 1877, when the North was occupying the South, lethal violence began to replace slavery as a way to maintain white supremacy. Black men were no longer property, and those were the words that I read before from Frederick Douglass and Ida B. Wells. And therefore, they were understood to be much more dangerous to the social order than they ever could have been under the very oppressive regime of slavery. What happens during Reconstruction is that whites begin to intertwine the political and economic rights of black men with this possibility of sex with white women. That is the point at which the Klan begins to ride. The Klan starts in 1866, and if you read through the Klan testimony, quite harrowing documents where the Klansmen describe what they're doing, you will see that the people who are defending the Klan in this testimony conflate political and economic rights and sex with white women. So that in one explanation, in one sentence, a Klansman will say, "We murdered this black man because he voted, and because he had sex with a white woman, or he was alleged to have sex with a white woman." So they will put those in the same sentence. Then what happens when Reconstruction is over and the South is no longer occupied by the North, then the conflation of politics and sex begins to shift until it becomes a conflation of political and economic rights, not with sex with white women, but the rape of white women, so that there is a gradual, over about a 30-year period, shift from worrying about sex and marriage to worrying about rape. And then that leads to the 1890s, in which white people literally made the argument that to stop the rape of white women, which of course was not happening in any case, but they made the case that it was, to stop what they understood to be the rape of white women, black men had to be disenfranchised. The vote had to be taken away, and that would somehow stop black men from this idea, and I repeat again that this was not really truly the case, but this idea that, black men were suddenly raping white women because they had been given political and economic rights.
Now the charge of rape in this period after the Civil War brought on a brutality, nothing short of death, and I'm just interpreting the facts as we go. And as I read it, lynchings, according to your statement in the book, lynchings were relatively rare before the Civil War, but between 1882 and 1900, more than 1,000 people in the South were killed by whites who took the law into their own hands. And lynchings peaked in 1892, and in all years, the overwhelming majority of victims were black men. So we're saying that the charge of rape now carried lynching and trial without jury and subsequently execution of black men.
Yes, everything you've said is correct. All the facts that you've interpreted are correct. And one of the differences between the era of the Klan, the 1870s, and the era of lynching, the 1880s and 1890s forward, Klan attacks, as most people know, were performed by men who were disguised in robes, and they were often events, almost always events, that took place at night. What happens in the era of lynching is that people begin to make the same kind of attacks, but the white people perpetrating the violence are no longer disguised. The murder takes place during the day and is open to the public. And what I would like to do for your listeners is describe some of what came to pass in these kinds of circumstances, and they are very disturbing and yet incredibly important to understand the kind of history that I'm trying to tell in this book. What happens beginning in the 1880s and peaking, as you said, in the 1890s and continuing well into the first half of the 20th century, I might add, and of course there are examples in the modern day that people have likened to lynching as well. Most lynchings were carried out by a mob. The victim of the lynching could be a stranger or a neighbor, somebody people knew. The charge could be suspected or it could be wholly fabricated. The capture of the victim often involved white people taking the man forcibly from the street or his workplace or his home in front of his family. If the man were already under arrest in a southern jail, it would mean taking him forcibly from the local jail with little or no objection from the white jailer or sheriff, and those figures often participated as well. Now, white people of all classes, rich, middling, and poor, would often come from miles away to participate in the spectacle, and sometimes they would bring their children and literally picnic supplies in tow. It was an event to watch. Notices would often be printed in local newspapers. Railroad companies would add extra cars or even run and advertise special trains. There are even cases where children were given the day off from school to attend a lynching. A crowd could be composed of hundreds or thousands, and that crowd would include local officers of the law. And then, of course, the method of murder might include mutilation, castration, even skinning, roasting, burning, hanging, and shooting, sometimes in combination with one another. And then, of course, afterwards, white spectators would often gather what they considered to be souvenirs, including bits of the rope or ashes or buttons or even body parts, toes, fingers, ears, teeth, bones. Shopkeepers might display those body parts in their windows, and W.B. Du Bois writes about this after the lynching of Sam Hose in 1899 in Georgia. Du Bois writes about walking to the streets of the newspaper, the Atlanta Constitution, to try to talk to the publishers of the newspaper about what had happened. And what happens is he comes upon a butcher shop in which, these are Du Bois' words, quote, they were exhibiting the fingers of Sam Hose. And at that point, Du Bois turns back, realizing that nothing he says to the editors of the white Atlanta Constitution would make a difference. And, of course, photographers also might sell pictures of the lynchings. And there has recently been an exhibit in New York City, and the permanent collection is at Emory University. The exhibit is called Witness, and is an exhibit, an incredible exhibit, a gathering together of these kinds of postcards of lynchings in which everything I have described is quite well documented. The final piece of information I'll give you here, if I may, I'd like to read a quotation from an African-American man in 1893, Henry McNeil Turner, who was a bishop of a church. And he made a very profound statement where he described lynching as following. He said, the local papers, and then these are his words, can advance what they are going to do, how and when it was done, how the rope broke, how many balls entered the Negro's body, how loud he prayed, how piteously he begged, what he said, how long he was left hanging, how many composed the mob, the number that were masked, whether they were prominent citizens or not, how the fire was built that burnt the raper, how the Negro was tied, how he was thrown into the fire, and the whole transaction. But still, the fiendish work was done by a set of unknown men. And what Turner was referring to there is that despite the fact that there were photographs of people participating in these gruesome lynchings, despite the fact that white newspapers published detailed accounts taken straight from the mouths of eyewitnesses, the coroner's jury invariably named the cause of death as, and these are haunting words in Southern history, quote, at the hands of persons unknown.
I would like to move and ask you another question. According to your research, did you find any information in the communities, in the white communities' response to black women who were raped and impregnated by their slave owners? Were there any legal sanctions levied against these men?
The answer to that is absolutely not. The rape of a black woman through the period of slavery and beyond in many ways, but certainly under slavery, the rape of a black woman was not a crime in the South. There were no laws against that kind of exploitation. And for that reason, as historians and as many Americans understand, it was an extremely widespread form of exploitation, the sexual exploitation of slave women by their white masters. And there was no legal recourse for black women in that kind of situation. And even if there had been, it would have been almost impossible for a black woman to bring those kinds of charges against white masters. Now, that doesn't mean that black women didn't resist. And there have absolutely been documented cases in the slave South of black women who murdered their masters. In those cases, as a form of resistance, because they could no longer tolerate the exploitation, in those cases, the black women themselves were usually executed. Nonetheless, despite the fact that these women were executed, they still demonstrated tremendous resistance in undertaking the murder of a white man in the slave South. Now, after the Civil War, when slavery no longer existed, although there may have been laws that pointed to the illegality of the rape of any woman by any man, those laws were not carried out, they were not enforced, and of course one of the things that happened after the Civil War was that black women, for at least a brief moment, withdrew their labor from white households. They no longer wanted to work in white households, and black men no longer wanted their wives to work in white households because they knew that they were subject to the same kind of sexual exploitation they had suffered under slavery. They were only able to withdraw that labor for a short period of time, of course, because of economic necessity. But the idea of working in a white household at any point through the late 19th and into the 20th century usually indicated the possibility and threat of sexual exploitation by white men.
I know that you have mentioned briefly the political system, but I'd like to maybe come back a little bit and talk just briefly about the Southern political system. During this period that we're now discussing, did the Southern political system involve itself in attempting to draw up legislation to prevent the sexual involvement between black men and white women, and what pieces of legislation, if you can share with us, did they draw up, and how effective was it?
Well, starting in the Reconstruction period and also during the 1890s forward, the post-war South did begin to write laws against marriage. Now, these laws differed from state to state. Some laws didn't permit marriage. Some laws were very specific about not permitting marriage and not permitting sexual relations at all. Often the laws did not differentiate between fornication and marriage. The punishments for transgressing these laws varied from making the marriage null and void to simply imposing a fine or imposing imprisonment or requiring the parties to leave the state. So, in fact, it was quite ambiguous, and often couples who, and there were white women and black men who wished to marry one another after the Civil War, and often those couples had to resort to various ruses in order to be able to do so. Sometimes they would leave one state and go to another. Sometimes I have found a few cases, I can't say this happened often, but I have found cases in which white women claimed to actually be black women, which of course is possible in a society based on the one-drop rule. In other words, you could actually be an African-American and not have any visible signs of being an African-American to white eyes. And so there are a number of Reconstruction and post-Reconstruction cases where women claimed that they were of African descent in order to marry black men. There were also cases in which people simply defied the laws, and the laws never caught up with them. By the mid-20th century, when the Loving versus Virginia case went to the Supreme Court and thereby outlawed all laws against marriage across color lines, there were at that time, I believe, 16 southern states in which those laws were still on the books in 1967, laws that prevented people of different races, which usually meant white people and whatever the various states considered to be non-white people, and that definition changed over time. There were 16 southern states that had laws in which those marriages were considered null and void, were not permitted.
Professor Hodes, we've just about come full circle, and I'd like to maybe wrap up my questioning with this particular point, and it asked you to maybe be a bit subjective in your research, and that is these relationships between white women and black men. Do you think they were just flings, fantasies, or real love? How would you answer that?
That is a fascinating question, and the hardest part of my research was determining the motivations of the people I was writing about. Those kinds of sentiments almost never entered the historical record. Now, what I found very interestingly, the few places I came across the recording of sentiments and emotions, I came across white women proclaiming their love for black men. Almost never did I come across the opposite. There were a number of antebellum cases, one I can think of in particular that's in the book, in Virginia, where a married white woman had a child by a black man. And when the law enforcement officer came to her door to serve her with an adultery warrant, she said to him, "I love this man, and I'm not sorry that I did this." Now, I have never found on record the voices of black men making the same proclamation. And I wonder if that is because it was simply too dangerous for black men to make such a claim that they loved white women. Now, I will say one other point about motivations, which is that when I began this research, I thought that I might find cases of white women and black men uniting against the patriarchs of the white South, coming together saying, "We are going to defy your power of race and your power of gender." I never found those kinds of cases. And I think it's very complicated because it's very hard to know, for example, why somebody like the servant Polly Lane entered into a liaison with Jim and then, when she became pregnant, turned around and accused her lover of rape. Did she never love him? Did she love him but was persuaded or forced by her family to make that accusation? There's no way to know. But it is important to point out, I think, that while there may have been cases of romantic love, and there probably were, the relations of power between free white women and enslaved black men were simply too unequal, in my mind, ever to create the conditions for a truly equal and loving relationship. And that is by way of saying that the white women who entered into these liaisons did, in the end, have more power than the black men because they were white in a society based on racial slavery and then in a society based on white supremacy. And so it's very hard to understand the nature of the relationships. And as I said, we don't have any voices of black men making clear their motivations or their love for white women. Now, we do have on the historical record some voices of black men making the point, this was during the Civil War, black men came out and confessed to a white man who was traveling through the South, an abolitionist, that they would sometimes have sex with white women in order to take revenge on white men. So that is one possible motive. Another possible motive is that for black men is that entering into a relationship with a black woman was very dangerous, was emotionally very dangerous. Either one of them might be sold away. Their children might be sold away. It was a harrowing experience. And so perhaps for that reason, black men, some black men, I should say, because most didn't, obviously, but some black men chose liaisons with white women. Another possibility is that the status of a white servant woman and the status of a slave man were not that different in their day-to-day lives and that these people actually had something in common. And I think that might have been the case for Polly Lane and Jim in North Carolina. She was the one who accused her lover of rape after the fact of her pregnancy, and yet they both worked in the same household for the same master. And if you read through the records, you will see that at one point they tried to steal money from another white man together, and they tried to run away. So there were all kinds of motivations, but very hard to say with certainty that many of these relationships were based on a kind of romantic love.
Today we've been speaking with Professor Martha Hodes. She's author of White Women, Black Men, Illicit Sex in the 19th Century South. Professor Hodes is employed at the Department of History at New York University. She joined me via telephone from New York City today. Thank you, Dr. Hodes, for spending time. And please know that I will be back in contact with you because your comments have been fascinating, informative, and certainly educational. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. It was my pleasure.
My guest today was Martha Hodes, author of the award-winning book, White Women, Black Men, Illicit Sex in the 19th Century South. Dr. Hodes is also winner of the Lincoln Prize. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.